and that California has such an outsized influence in what happens in the wider United States that New York and other states quickly follow. And as we start getting that kind of shift, we can get national-level shifts, national-level policy, and that ultimately it's the United States, of course, that has the power to make international agreements happen. So it's having some sense in one's own mind that local action leads to national action is terribly important. And, of course, there's great precedence for that. If you think about the Nixon-era administration, a highly conniving and cynical politician brought the most far-reaching environmental legislation because up and down, town by town, city by city, people went to fight against polluting interests. And eventually that got so damaging on the corporations that they themselves clamored for federal regulation. So we have, you know, all forms of social change, five-day work week, eight-hour work day, suffragettes, civil rights movement, all of these things ended up giving us national policy, and they start very often with local action. I think we really need to foster those kinds of ideas, and we need to demonstrate and show people how to get together as activists and advocates and go to bat for their world.
Tell us about climate-friendly measures taken at your university, UC San Diego.
Yes. The university, University of California, San Diego, as well as the other nine campuses that make up the UC system, have burned fossil gas, emitting about 1 million tons of carbon dioxide. It's just mind-boggling. And that's the case in most U.S. campuses, by the way, the large ones. They have their own power plants. And so we have, you know, a small band of valiant activist students, faculty, and staff have sort of battled against the system since about 2019, and we certainly made some headway. For example, we have slayed the offset strategy, so the system assumed that it could keep on burning fossil gas and just pretend that it was going to make good by buying some carbon offsets, and we've exposed that as the thorough nonsense that it is. And now they've allocated $13 million for electrification planning, and each of the campuses sort of going through a process now of actually seeing how it would get off the gas. Now, they still are burning gas, but that is an interim victory for us in our struggle.
And aside from the book, what else are you up to these days, Adam?
So the book is connected with the teaching I do, but I'm also doing, I guess there's three components. There's my teaching, and there's the research, and then there's my activism and organizing. So on the research front, I am trying to develop a research program broadly in social science that really helps understand how to achieve a greater social mobilization. What are the psychological and sociological factors that determine whether people will join together in groups and start advocating for their world and fighting for it? So I'm trying to understand that experimentally by doing studies, and I'm also an activist and organizer, both in the University of California and also in the city of San Diego.
From the University of California, San Diego, we have been speaking with Professor Adam Aaron. His latest book is The Climate Crisis. It's from Cambridge University Press. Find lots of links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org and check out aaronlab.org. That's aaronlab.org. Adam, thank you for helping us out this week on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Why are we still stuck in the fossil fuel age, surrounded by toxic chemicals and bad air? When state legislators are arrested, when the Koch brothers cheat and chemical companies leak, award-winning reporter Navina Sadasivam is there. Navina is ready with her degree in chemical engineering and a master's in environmental and science reporting. She has reported breaking news for the Texas Observer, Inside Climate News, and ProPublica. Now Sadasivam is senior staff writer at Grist, the progressive magazine, nonprofit, and website. From New York, Navina Sadasivam, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into the toxic pit, what happened to the treasured Texas Observer, and what have we lost?
That's a great question. Well, I won't say that we've lost the Texas Observer just yet. I know they had a great round of funding in the last couple of weeks, and they seem to be rallying. There's so much support for that publication, and it's so critical. It's such a critical voice in Texas, so I'm glad that it's finding its way. It's in troubled waters, but I do think that I hope that it will make it out okay.
For our international listeners, what is the Texas Observer?
Yeah, Yeah, the Texas Observer is a progressive magazine based out of Austin. You know, it's well into its sixth or seventh decade of publication, and it does really important investigative and feature reporting on issues in Texas. Often when other media outlets in Texas aren't covering an issue, the Texas Observer's reporters are usually there, and they're diving into the stories that need to be told but aren't being told.
So let's start with some of your stories, mainly the new way to stop people protesting destruction of the planet. Just label environmentalists terrorists and send them off to prison. Problem solved. Tell us why pipelines are good and greens are bad in Utah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Utah, really interestingly enough, is the latest state to pass some of these so-called critical infrastructure bills. As you may know, critical infrastructure is just sort of a broad term that essentially refers to any facilities that are essential to national security and public health and safety. And pipelines kind of fall under this umbrella. And what Utah did in the last few weeks is they passed legislation that essentially makes impeding or inhibiting with activities related to the construction or operation of these critical infrastructure facilities a first-degree felony. And I think, you know, it's coming out of concern that we've seen just a rash of attacks on electrical substations. And so these bills were passed essentially to give law enforcement and prosecutors additional tools. But what ends up happening is, unintentionally or intentionally, they have basically pulled in a whole lot of protest activity into the scope of the bill. So if you're out protesting a pipeline construction facility in Utah and you end up blocking a road, for instance, or you're chaining yourself to the construction equipment, you know, now you could be charged under these new laws that make inhibiting or impeding the operation of a critical infrastructure facility a first-degree felony. And in Utah, a first-degree felony is punishable by 5 years to life in prison. So these are really serious charges that you could find yourself facing. So Utah is one of the states that has passed this particular sort of law. And it's not the only one. It's the 19th state in the United States to do that. There have been a whole bunch of other states, including Texas and Louisiana and North Dakota, that have passed these sorts of laws in the last few years.
So let me get this straight. People who believe climate science, who want to protect a future for coming generations, people who speak up, they're the criminals. They're the terrorists, not the fossil fuel companies. How did that happen in America?
Yeah, there are a few reasons for it. I mean, I think in the aftermath of the Standing Rock protests in 2016, late 2016, early 2017, a lot of states and state lawmakers started looking at the protests that were happening in North Dakota and said, hey, we don't want that to ever happen in our states, right? This sort of massive protest activity is something that we want to try and avoid in our states. And so initially, the motivation for these bills seemed to be coming from the sort of large-scale protests that we saw with the Dakota Access Pipeline, but also other pipelines like the Line 5 pipeline that Enbridge has been trying to build in Minnesota. And so lawmakers were reacting to both the media attention around these protests and in some cases how violent some of these protests became because of the clashes between protesters and law enforcement. And so those first few states that passed these sorts of laws in 2017, 18, 19 were responding to the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, I think. But more recently, it does look like, at least in Utah, the motivation has kind of shifted. In the last few months in the U.S., we've seen some attacks on electrical substations where people sort of drive by and shoot at electrical substations. And in some cases, they ended up taking down parts of the grid, and people lost access to power for several hours, you know, which can be very disruptive. And so in an attempt to essentially increase penalties for that kind of behavior, at least in Utah, we saw this bill being passed. So the motivation has kind of shifted over the years, it seems like. But originally, at least, it was a result of, you know, the protests that we saw in Standing Rock.
Well, if you can't throw your critics in jail, just buy off their state legislators with buckets of secret cash. I know you weren't the lead on this story, but could you tell us a little bit about the grist headline that said how a $60 million bribery scandal helped Ohio pass the worst energy policy in the country?
Yeah, so this is a story that has been unfolding in Ohio for the last few years. Ohio a few years ago passed a piece of legislation called HB1 that essentially handed a large number of subsidies, more than $1 billion in subsidies, to nuclear and coal plants in the state. It later turned out that the lead lawmaker in the Ohio House of Representatives, Speaker Larry Householder, was essentially operating a slush fund, and utilities were contributing to it, and he was drawing from the slush fund to both help himself get elected, but also help a number of other Republican conservative lawmakers in the House get elected. And, you know, in return for essentially being able to operate the slush fund and receive funds from the utilities, he helped push through HB1. You know, FBI agents since arrested Larry Householder, and there was a federal jury that essentially affirmed these allegations and found him guilty of criminal conspiracy last month. And so that's the story that we kind of covered. And you can read about it in a lot more detail at grist.org. I covered the most recent news about the federal jury, largely affirming the allegations by the FBI. But we also have a deeper dive that goes into all of the sordid details that were involved in setting up this slush fund and how it worked on our website.
And the sickest part of that story is there is a way to recall terrible legislation. Voters have an option. But the dark money boys managed to fix the Ohio referendum as well. It's almost like there was no way out.
Right. In this particular case, you know, it's quite egregious, this particular story, where you see the direct sort of relationship between lobbyists and lawmakers and the extent to which that relationship can be pushed in a way that really harms citizens in Ohio.
You know, my other takeaway from this grist reporting is something I realized in my own research back in the 1990s. People assume that opposition to renewables, corrupt or not, comes from big oil and gas multinationals like Exxon or Shell. Sure, that has been documented in many countries, but there's a second group of dark players, the electricity utility industry owners. For example, I found several scientists who denied the climate crisis. They were paid not by big oil and gas directly, but by utility industry corporations. Have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You see that even in the case with the protest laws, the anti-protest laws that we were talking about. A number of the groups that show up in support of that kind of legislation often tend to be utilities, too. So in Utah, for instance, Dominion Energy and a couple of other utilities in the state showed up sort of pushing lawmakers to get this legislation passed. So, yeah, they absolutely do have something to gain from those sorts of laws being passed and, in general, from pushing back against renewables because they already have so much invested in the fossil fuel infrastructure in these many states.
With your expertise, Navina, in chemistry, you and Grist report on everyday chemical pollution that seems institutionalized in America, but sometimes we win a little. Tell us about your April 6th article on new EPA rules.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, for a long, long time, we've had a number of environmental justice advocates talk about, you know, the cumulative risks of breathing in a number of chemicals, right? So if you live in the industrial corridors of Texas or Louisiana or in parts of Ohio, you are surrounded by industry. And these chemical plants are putting out a number of chemicals, benzene, ethylene oxide, chloroprene, 1,3-butadiene, all of these different toxic carcinogenic chemicals that you are breathing in on a daily basis. Often these homes are very close to some of these facilities. And so for years, people have asked that, you know, the EPA have more stringent regulations on these more toxic chemicals, right? One of the things that has happened over the last 3 or 4 decades since the Clean Air Act was passed in the 1970s is we've done a really good job of reducing the amount of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide in the air. the challenge now is to get at some of these more toxic chemicals, these volatile organics and other kind of carcinogenic chemicals that are maybe not emitted in as large amounts as sulfur dioxide, for instance, but they are, you know, extremely toxic and have real health effects. And so, you know, after years of advocacy from environmental justice groups and public health advocates, we saw the EPA this week propose a new set of regulations that target about 200 chemical plants. The vast majority of these chemical plants are in Texas and Louisiana. They require the companies to essentially monitor for 6 different really toxic chemicals, some of which I listed earlier, ethylene oxide, 1,3-butadiene, for instance, benzene. And then they also require these facilities to install all types of different equipment to reduce the amount of these emissions. So these emissions, the chemicals are supposed to be burned off, for instance, at the flares. Sometimes these flares aren't very efficient, so the standards have new efficiency requirements of these plants. They're supposed to look for leaks in different equipment and make sure that these chemicals aren't, you know, leaking out of the different facilities. These are new rules, and I think advocates, especially in Texas and Louisiana, were celebrating the announcement of these rules because they've been a long time coming, and it's something that advocates have pushed for decades.
Navina, isn't it strange so many mega chemical plants just happen to be located in places heavily populated by poor people of color and not in wealthy white enclaves? What do you think?
Right, and this, you know, has so much to do with the history of the United States. Redlining, discriminatory practices that have resulted in, you know, black and brown and poor people living in parts of the country that are closest to industrial facilities, right? So this is not an accident. There are specific regulatory policies at play here. But yes, you know, if you look at the facilities that we're talking about, some of the most toxic, the largest, most hazardous chemical plants in the nation, they are in places where wealthy folks don't want to live, right? And that makes a whole lot of sense. Of course, if you have access and if you have opportunities to live elsewhere, you wouldn't choose to stay in a place where, you know, you're surrounded by industry and breathing in toxic chemicals.
Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are plunging into the dark depths of corporate greed with award-winning investigative reporter Navina Sadasivam, senior staff writer at Grist. Tell us about the Koch brothers' company plot you and reporter Clayton Aldern unearthed in Texas just this past February.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a story that, you know, we've been working on for almost a year, and it is a chemical plant in Texas as well. Also in one of those industrial corridors that I was just talking about. It is in Port Arthur. It is a coke-producing plant, petroleum coke, which is sort of the leftover unrefined material that comes out of, you know, crude oil production. And this is a facility that for years has been trying to evade environmental laws. And what we found was that its most recent attempt has been to try to evade an air quality monitor that was put near it. This is a plant that was built in the 1930s, and so it's already grandfathered into a number of environmental laws because it precedes the 1970s Clean Air Act. And what we found was, you know, when regulators installed an air quality monitor to kind of keep an eye on this facility just because of the amount of sulfur dioxide that it was releasing, what the facility ended up doing is it gained access to the monitor, was able to get the regulatory agency to hand over air quality data from the monitor, which it then used to figure out when it needed to change its operations so it wouldn't set the monitor off. So when the air blew in the direction of the air monitor and could pick up the emissions, the facility would then set about changing its operations so that its emissions weren't picked up as much. When the air was not blowing towards the monitor and the monitor wouldn't be able to pick up these emissions, it was presumably not changing its operations as much. And so we were able to get our hands on this internal data, 2.5 years of internal data, as well as internal emails that showed us just a sort of sophisticated system that they set up to help detect when air emissions, air quality emissions were going up and when the monitor was going to be able to pick them up versus when it wasn't. And we found that more often than not, when the air was blowing in the direction of the monitor and the monitor was more likely to pick up these emissions, the facility was turning off some of its kilns and reducing its production capacity in a way that reduced the amount of emissions that were coming out of its smokestacks. So this is a story that resulted in sort of a 6,000-word deep dive into this facility. And we spoke to a former EPA enforcement officer, you know, who looked at some of these findings and said, you know, this looks like a criminal violation of the Clean Air Act.
It always amazes me people all over America donate millions for cancer research. Millions of our loved ones are lost to cancer. It hurts. And the government spends more billions of dollars, if not trillions, for a cure. Why not try to stop these cancer cases at the source, banning carcinogenic chemicals from our lives?
That's a great question. And I think part of it is the regulatory approach that we take in the United States. For instance, in Europe, when a specific chemical is being used or emitted, it is incumbent on the industry that's using or emitting that chemical to prove that it is not carcinogenic. Whereas in the U.S., we have a regulatory system that essentially waits for the evidence to stack up to prove that something is carcinogenic before it gets banned. And so it's just a sort of a different approach.
Republicans love the fossil fuel regime, even as their states are struck time and time again with climate-driven disasters. But both parties keep subsidizing climate-killing industries. When President Biden spoke at the Glasgow Climate Summit in November 2021, he called for climate action. I wish Grist would investigate one simple thing. Why did Joe Biden recently approve drilling in the fragile Arctic? I'm talking about that Willow project in the very north of Alaska. He has to know most Democratic voters are worried about climate change. Why did he do it? Who gains? Is it possible to look into that?
That's a good question. And, you know, I know some of my coworkers have been following the Willow project really closely, and they've been covering it. And my understanding is that President Biden has claimed that, you know, for legal reasons, he's unable to deny that project because they would be taken to court, they would be sued over it. And I think the legal advice has been to him that any such decision would be overturned by the courts and would not have legal merit. So I know that's the defense that the administration has provided, but again, that's definitely something that my coworkers are looking into.
We just had a case like that in Canada, and it kind of ties into your own pipeline investigations. Lauded as a new green prime minister, Justin Trudeau got the government to buy and build a pipeline from the Alberta tar sands to the port of Vancouver. Private industry wouldn't touch it. It is wildly unpopular. Hundreds of protesters were arrested. And the construction cost has quadrupled already. You just have to ask yourself, why do even the green-sounding ones, why do they do it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. And I can't speak to the pipeline in Canada. I haven't been following that closely.
The American Society of Magazine Editors just honored Grist with a 2023 National Magazine Award. Why do you think Grist Magazine keeps publishing stories that bigger corporate media are content to ignore forever?
Well, part of the reason I think is, you know, we've been around for a really long time. We were established in the 90s, and we've been covering climate issues and environmental issues back when they were seen as sort of niche issues. You know, I remember a few years ago, you know, when I first got started, you know, I was sort of taken aside and told, hey, are you sure you want to be an environmental reporter? Because this is such a niche field to go into, and are you sure you don't want to cover politics or business or something broader, you know, if nothing for the job security of it. And I think one of the things that has evolved over the years is Grist has built up a real knowledge base on these issues. And so we're able to dive in deeper. We've been covering these issues for a really long time. And we have a specific lens through which we're looking at these stories, right? We're looking at a number of stories through the climate lens, and we're also looking at it through the solutions lens, right? So not only do we want to cover what the problems are, but we also want to highlight what potential solutions could be. And by that, I don't mean cheerleading for these solutions, but taking a very critical, skeptical view of these solutions and what they can offer us. And so I think what the ASME award sort of recognizes is just the work, the body of work that we have put out over the years and the expertise that we've built up, you know, within GRIST among the reporters. So, yeah, it was really exciting for us to win that award. We were nominated and we were finalists last year, but it's really, really cool and a great recognition to be able to bring home that award.
Well, poking around chemical plants in Texas and Louisiana and maybe Utah, it sounds a little risky. Many years ago, a friend of mine, like you, a trained American chemist, worked to catalog toxic materials, and she specialized in cancer-causing chemicals spread by the incineration industry. Then her house burned down, suspiciously. Local authorities declared it accidental, zero investigation. Is it still dangerous to question authority in America?
I don't think I've personally faced anything quite like that. I'm really sorry to hear that that happened to your friend. I do think for the most part, you know, I'm originally from India, and I think about the kinds of repercussions that journalists in India and elsewhere around the world face. And I think of particularly the environmental activists, indigenous activists all around the world who are persecuted for speaking truth to power and asking questions and trying to hold those in power accountable. By those measures, I do think journalists here in the U.S. are protected under the First Amendment. And, you know, especially at GRIST, we enjoy quite a bit of support from editors. And so I do feel that there's a lot of protection here for journalists to be able to speak up and hold people accountable. That being said, there are many threats to the journalism industry here in the U.S. as well. One thing we've seen is we've seen a lot of local media wither and sort of die away, and so there are entire news deserts in the country, right, where you don't have as much accountability reporting happening just because of the way the industry has evolved over the years, and you know, a lot of it has been concentrated on the coast. That's one sort of big, massive threat. And then, of course, you know, one of the things that we face as investigative journalists trying to do accountability reporting is there's always the threat of lawsuits. Anytime you write about corporations or any powerful person, you face the threat of lawsuits. And, you know, for small nonprofits, it can be easy to be buried under legal costs. So that sort of threat always exists, I think.
As journalists, we've been told again and again, wrap up every story with some hope, with a promise we can still get out of this mess. Otherwise, they say, people will give up and just party till they drop. Well, that seems to be happening anyway. What do you think? Are we obligated to serve up hope for dessert?
I don't think there's an obligation to serve up dessert. To serve up hope for dessert. That's a funny way of putting it. But I do think that increasingly we're seeing polling showing that those who are reading the news are less and less engaged with it and are less likely to want to read the news and stay engaged because of what they feel is just a negativity bias, right? Journalists tend to report on the terrible things that are happening in the world, and when you only are reminded of all of the awful things happening, it's hard to hold out hope. And so that's, you know, it's one of the many reasons why we think solutions reporting is so important. And again, not to take a very Pollyanna-ish view of solutions, but to actually ask real hard, tough questions of these solutions and examine very closely whether these solutions will help us get out of the climate crisis. And so having that lens is really important, I think.
As we finish up, can you give us a peek at some of the reporting you and your team are working on coming up at GRIST?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my colleagues and I were working on a series of stories on ethylene oxide, which is one of the chemicals that the EPA is regulating more strictly, the rules that we just talked about. So we have some stories planned around that particular chemical just because of its toxic nature and the number of people who are exposed to it all across the U.S. I have another project in the works about a number of petrochemical plants and refineries and their emissions in Texas and Louisiana. And a number of my colleagues are also hard at work, you know, working on a number of projects about the LNG industry in the U.S., about fortress conservation and indigenous activists all across the world. Yeah, so that's a little bit of what we have coming up.
from Grist. We have been speaking with top environmental reporter Navina Sadasivam. Find links to all the great articles we just talked about at grist.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Navina, it's been a treat to talk with you, really. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.